So everybody came out on a cold night with a threat of snow, so that's pretty awesome. Who's here for the first time this evening? Welcome. That's it. Okay, great. Great. We'll do a little review, and then I'm happy to talk with you after for a few minutes if you have any questions. Have you ever been in a Buddhist center before? Okay. You're in the company of many who had never been in one. So, and we do have a book that kind of explains what's on the altar and what some of the tankas are, and we'll talk about that again later, but you're welcome to come up, touch things, look at the book. And it does a pretty good job explaining. So you're only one person's new. I did put the handouts back there from last week, so feel free to grab those. And if anybody didn't pick any up, you're welcome to pick those up tonight. And then there's more on our website, which is up there. And my name is Karen Mastriani, and I'm one of many volunteers here at the center. So before we start, I guess, if you brought your cell phones in, I kept mine out to make sure I put it on silence, or as we say, meditation mode, so that it doesn't go off. But somebody's will go off before the end of the 5 weeks. I promise you, it'll probably be mine. So we have a couple of things for tonight. We'll do a brief review from last week, just a brief one, and we'll do a couple of meditations. We're going to talk about the history of Buddhism and how it traveled from India throughout Asia and then to the West. So we'll talk a little bit about that history and the spread. We'll do a little bit more of a detailed discussion on the Buddhist view of mind and what mind is, and we'll talk a little bit about what it means to be a Buddhist. Actually, after tonight, pretty much, we're going to be talking about the path and what Buddhists believe and what Buddhists follow, and this will just kind of get that started a little bit, and then we'll give more details about the Four Noble Truths, which I just mentioned last week and touched on. Whatever we don't finish up, we'll finish up next week. So, so we'll go ahead and we'll set our intentions and do just a brief meditation. We'll do a body scan meditation tonight. That is one of the handouts on the Buddhism in a Nutshell website, so you have access to this meditation. We talked about the sitting posture last week, and you know, I'm not going to go into as much detail. That you know that some of the key, they all have every one of those seven postures has a purpose. But the biggest thing is that it's just telling your mind this is a different body position. It's different than what I normally do, and I need to focus. And so it just changes your whole perspective. And so if you just get in the habit of practicing that posture and whatever is comfortable for you, but just a little bit different than you would sit down and chit-chat with your friends or watch TV or, you know, any other time when you're seated. And every piece of this posture has a purpose. But, you know, one of the biggies is straight back. Very relaxed shoulders, but nice straight back. When you're in the chair, that means sometimes I scoot forward in the chair, but you just don't want to slouch back. So whatever's comfortable for you. And then your chin slightly down so that the crown of your head is just facing upward. And if I could pull a string, they say if you could pull a string from the top of your head, your vertebrae would just line up like a stack of coins. So nice straight back. Hands comfortable. In our tradition, right hand on your palm with thumbs touching, but you can have your hands on your legs and on your lap. You know, they say if your palms are turned up, you're more open to receive. So think about that. Sometimes I always have mine down. I don't know what that says about me. And then your arms a little away from your body, jaw and your mouth. Relax so your teeth aren't tight, they're slightly opened, and your tongue is just up at the roof of your mouth behind the top of your, in the back of your top teeth. And then your eyes, some people meditate with their eyes open. I find that very distracting, especially when I'm out there and the teacher's sitting there staring at me. but for me, it's distracting to have my eyes open. But some people, that's the way they meditate. So you do what's comfortable for you. I invite you to close your eyes. And they say just keep a little slit of light open so that you don't get too drowsy. The idea is attention, awareness, focus. And so as much as you can do to stay alert, we do that. So eyes slightly opened or almost closed. And just take a couple of nice deep breaths. Let go of any tension with every exhale. And just begin to come into this room, letting go of work or school, whether you work at home or outside of the home. And then just set your intentions for why you're here. Our time is so valuable and so precious, yet we all made the effort to be here. And so just return your breathing to a comfortable, natural rhythm. And just focus on your breath just for a little while as you inhale and exhale. And just follow each in-breath and out-breath. You could even say in and out. And remember, the practice is to notice when your mind wanders and bring it back to the breath, just the in-breath and the out-breath. So this meditation is scanning the body. And it's just focusing your attention on your physical body. And just bring your awareness to the lowermost point of your body, where your body is in contact with the earth. And feel the substance and earthy character of your body. And just concentrate for a moment on that contact, on the weight and substance of this physical form. It could be at your feet, or your backside, or your knees. And pay attention to the character of your mind, your consciousness, while you're focusing here. And slowly and mindfully move your attention upward through your body. Pay close attention to every aspect of your body, your physical sensations. And as you're scanning the body, note areas of tension. You can try to relax them or just notice and name that tension if that helps. And note sensations of coolness or warmth. Note places where one part of your body is touching another part. Move up through your legs, your hips, your hands in your lap. And just note any curves of your body silhouette. Move upward your belly, your waist, the curves of your arms. And continue to move upward, the rising and falling of your chest with your breathing, the curves of your shoulders. Move upward slowly and mindfully. Really pay special attention to your shoulders, neck, and jaw. And that's where we hold so much tension. And if there's tension in any of those areas, just try to relax those. Even move your jaw side to side. Relax any tension behind your eyes and your forehead. And just breathe into those areas where you really hold tension. And let it go. And move still upward, the tilt of your head until you reach the crown of your head. And allow your attention to rest at your crown for just a moment. Pay attention to the character of your mind, your consciousness, while you're focusing here. Is your mind's character different while you're concentrating here at the crown of your head than it was when you were focusing on the lowermost point of your body? What differences can you note? And then slowly move your attention back downward through your body in the same way. Move slowly, mindfully, noting everything about your body as you move your attention back downward. And then bring your attention all the way back down to the cushion or floor where your body is in contact with the earth. And again, focus your concentration at this point and note the character of your consciousness when focusing here. Again, note the nature of your mind state when concentrating here and any differences from your mind state when concentrating at your crown. And then finally, just dedicate your positive energy, any insights that you gained, to your own well-being and happiness, and the well-being and happiness of all living beings. And then, you know, they say that, and there's a note at the bottom of the meditation, that the more you practice and the more you learn about, you know, following and scanning your body and just checking your mind state as you're scanning through, kind of the more you learn about your consciousness and the differences when you're, you know, focusing on the crown of your head versus lower on the, where your body's touching the earth and that earthiness. Did anybody notice any difference? And remember, you have to talk in the microphone. Did you notice any difference when you were doing that? Anybody have anything to share? No pressure. Thank you.
Can we hear me?
And you've got to hold it up like a...
You've got to hold it close.
There okay. You go.
I think when I was concentrating on, like, the crown of my head, it made me feel lighter and more like, I imagine, like, the string coming out the top of my head, whereas when I was focusing on my legs and sitting in the cushion and just feeling more grounded, I felt like... I don't know, just down and closer to the earth. But up here, I felt like somebody was kind of like pulling me up a little bit.
Upward lightness. Anybody else experience that? Or anything different? Because everybody's experience is different, right? Okay. A lot of times you feel that lightness, that sense of openness. And then you just feel that groundedness and that connection. And they're both important, you know, and you can play with going back and forth. The more you do it, kind of the more it increases your awareness, especially when you're relaxed and you're not sitting here feeling like you have to perform. I just find that hard. And, you know, last week we talked about intentions and dedications, and it really gives purpose and focus, and I encourage you to do it through, you know, throughout your day. But, you know, when you set your intention, they say it's more powerful than just doing something. Like, you set the intentions to meditate, or you set the intentions to do something positive, and, you know, you gain more out of that. Then when you dedicate it, it's like one, you're just taking that one little drop of merit or any potential benefit we get out of this, and you're dropping it in the ocean so that it'll just collect, and everybody's, you know, collects all together. So it's that much more huge. And it, you know, one drop will evaporate. We're in the ocean, it'll last. Some people explain it like planting a seed, and you're really pressing it into the ground and covering it up, you know, cementing the deal. You know, you're just making sure that it's all protected. So notice that as you keep practicing. Oh, I keep forgetting to go to my lovely meditation slide. That's all right. You didn't miss anything. So did any questions come up this last week based on last week's discussion or anything you read during the week? It's true, isn't it? I mean, it's a joke, but it's the truth, you know? And then we beat ourselves up and we judge, which, man, let go of that. As soon as that judging mind starts, yeah, there goes my judging mind. I just label it. Kindly, gently come back to the breath, you know? And actually, you can practice that judging mind all day long. Ah, there goes my judging mind, either towards yourself or other people. Pull it back and let it go. It can be quite helpful. And so remember, if you notice any errors in anything that I said, it's the teacher, not that I'm a teacher, it's the facilitator of this class, and not the teachings, because there aren't any errors in Buddhist teachings. And if you notice something or I say something backwards, I mean, please bring it up to the whole group and anybody who's listening or going to listen to the recording, because we do want to make sure we get this as correct as we can get it. So feel free to mention things, okay? Especially if there's something you read and you read it differently. Okay, so for the review from last week, we talked a little bit about meditation, and we did review the posture, and we'll discuss a little bit more about meditation, what it means in this tradition and the different types of meditation. And I gave a history of our center, our lovely, beautiful center, which I'm happy to talk with you after and give you more of a history. I think that handout back there actually gives you a little bit of a history of the center. And the only thing that I'll mention is that we are part of the FPMT, the Federation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition. And we'll talk a little bit about Mahayana tonight and define that just a little bit. We went through the life of Shakyamuni Buddha, and we'll quickly review that tonight just to emphasize a few key points. I introduced the Four Noble Truths, and we'll go in a little bit more depth. Discovering Buddhism and other teachings here at the center go into far more depth on the Four Noble Truths. I mean, you honestly, that's the foundation, you know, the foundational teaching. And once we can begin to grasp that, it kind of helps everything else make sense. So I can't emphasize the importance of the Four Noble Truths. And it's amazing. Like, every time you hear a teaching on it, it's like, oh, like, you just can go a little deeper, so it can be very powerful for our practice. And then, you know, remember the purpose of this Buddhism in a Nutshell class is just to provide a tiny snippet into what Buddhism is all about and give you broad brush overview of some of the key principles not to convert anybody, not to even persuade anybody to become a Buddhist. In fact, I've heard the Holiness the Dalai Lama say, you know, we shouldn't be telling anybody to be a Buddhist. We should just tell everybody to be the best they can be at whatever their practice is, or no practice at all. And if we can take something from these classes to be that best at whatever, you know, we call ourselves, that in itself would be the most beneficial thing we could do. And some of you may have picked this as your path, or thinking it might be your path, and wanting to just kind of, you know, learn more and delve a little deeper. So curiosity, learning, getting your toes in the water, whatever the reason, this gives you a little bit of an overview here. So, you know, when we talked about the Buddha, you know, I mentioned that Buddhism is not technically a religion in the sense of that word, although most of us consider it is kind of a religion. It's just a little bit different. And, you know, mostly it's about kindness and compassion, and it's a science, and it's a philosophy, and it's a way of life. And the Buddha is not a god. You don't pray to a god or worship a god like you do in religions. There is no worship despite of everything you see around here. It's just for our minds and not things that we're worshiping. He's not a divine being or a supreme chief overlooking all of us. Any of you raised Catholic? I always think, you know, the venial sin and the mortal sin, and somebody's up there just with the scorecard. And no, the Buddha's not doing that. but he's just the embodiment of just complete compassion, just, you know, deep, pervasive compassion and wisdom. And that's what it means to be a Buddha, to become that enlightened one. And if you recall, Shakyamuni Buddha was born a human. He was born, you know, his father was a king, his mom a queen, he was a prince, he was Prince Siddhartha. Shakya is the clan he was born into and in Nepal, and then Muni means sage, so he was, you know, the great sage of the Shakya clan. He lived a very enriched life, had all his wants met, anything he could ever want, and he was separated from any form of suffering, yet purposefully, because his dad wanted him to be a king. But then he realized there was suffering. It was just excruciatingly painful to him to realize how people were suffering outside those gates, and that one day all his loved ones would suffer as he would. So he left the palace to searching for an answer for why. Why is there suffering? What's the meaning of life? Why are we all here? And he tried different methods for about 6 years with five other ascetics. They kind of roamed around together, and really extreme austerity, really pretty, a lot of self-deprivation. Until he was meditating under the Bodhi tree, he realized the middle way, and he was able to remove all negative states of mind, all obscurations of mind, and develop only positive states of mind when he achieved an enlightenment. He went on to teach for 40 years after sitting under the Bodhi tree and reaching enlightenment. And he had many teachings, but three main ones, and they were called the turning of the wheel of Dharma. And we mentioned the Dharma's protects our mind. There are teachings that help to protect our mind. And this is the ultimate state of what Mahayana Buddhists are trying to do. We're trying to develop only positive states of mind and remove all obscurations, all negative states of mind, all delusions from our mind. And that's what we're doing with our practice, so that we can have that state of infinite compassion and wisdom. And they refer to that as, you'll hear it talked about as two wings of a bird. You have to have both. You have to have that compassion, but you have to have the wisdom of reality and the wisdom to know what is needed. I've heard Geshe La often say, compassion, but no wisdom. It doesn't help very much, you know. And if you have wisdom without compassion, then you're not very helpful at all. So you need both wings. And we'll discuss that in the last two sessions of this Buddhism in a Nutshell class. So the Buddha, when he taught for the 40 years, he has 84,000 different teachings, and all 84,000 surround our altar. We have all 84 here, and he did those before his death at the age of 80. There are no contradictions to any of the teachings. They're just meant to be whatever the students need. We all have different interests. We have different learning capacities. We're ready to hear some things and not ready to hear others, and so those teachings were meant to speak to all of that, and not meant, there are no contradictions with that. And then we also discussed that Buddhism is kind of the study of the mind in relation to happiness and suffering. And Buddhists accept and follow the Buddhist teachings, that compassion, happiness, love, kindness, peace, optimism. Those were the teachings that the Buddha gave us. And some of the, you know, the negative things that we're trying to get rid of are jealousy, anger, pride, all the negative states of mind that you think of, our judgment, etc. The view in Buddhism is that the positive states of mind, a compassion, kind, loving person, those are the virtuous qualities, and that those are believed to be the natural state of our mind. It's believed those virtuous qualities are our true nature. And the negative ones really are delusions or obscurations that we can eliminate. And it's possible to accomplish these. It just needs focus, study, and then being free from just lessen our distractions. And we'll talk about ways that we do that. And then those three main teachings, those turnings of the wheel, the first one was in Deer Park, the Four Noble Truths, and we will talk about that tonight. But before we talk about the Four Noble Truths, just a little bit about the history and how Buddhism spread throughout the world and continuing to spread as it came here, which is kind of great. So the original transmissions from the Buddha, it's an oral tradition. They're oral translations, and they were just passed down from generation to generation. That oral tradition, it remains strong, even though now we have the teachings in writing. Not only do we have them in writing, they've been translated into all languages. So anybody, anywhere can pick up and study the teachings of the Buddha. So it's actually kind of amazing. And so as this oral tradition formed, memorization was really the key. I mean, that really was the foundation. And so no matter where it spread or all these traditions, it started out memorizing. The monks in Tibet would memorize full texts. Geshe La knows full texts by heart. I mentioned the Lam Rim is three books, three really thick books. We're going to slice the Lam Rim into the main chunks of it in this class. But His Holiness gave a teaching in Pennsylvania. I don't remember when that was, years ago. By heart, like he had an outline and just taught the whole 10 days just by heart, because they know these teaching. It's in their hearts. They memorize it. It's part of their being. And that oral tradition remains and is really, really important. And the key with that oral tradition is when a teacher gives a teaching, they will say state the lineage. I got this teaching from whoever, you know, they gave me this transmission and they got it from, you know, this Rinpoche and they got it from this Lama and they'll trace it all the way back. So, you know, it's pretty amazing. And when the lineage is lost, that's it. It's gone. And we have had teachings lost because the lineage was broken. And it's said to be a time of darkness or a degeneration or degenerative times. And we're in a degenerative time. You know, the Buddhist teachings are more than 2,500 years ago. We're getting further and further away. And at some point, there will be generations born that won't know the Buddhist teaching until, you know, another Buddha comes or, you know, the next light shines. So in the U.S., oral traditions and memorization, we know about our memories, right? And how good they are. And we don't trust them because, you know, you watch the same episode and everybody has a different interpretation of what they heard and it's completely different than what I heard and what you remember today that happened yesterday is completely different from what really happened. So we have to really work on that. As kids, we memorize things. But, you know, memorizing some of the prayers, some of the teachings, some of the mantras, that way you always have them with you. So whether you have a book or not, that memorization is really helpful. And then instead of reading, you can just sit and think about, you know, oh, yeah, you know, line by line, kind of break it down. That can be part of your meditation. So memorizing is still really important. So this oral transmission spread throughout India, and it really spread throughout India first before it went anywhere else, and then it went to Sri Lanka and throughout Asia, and then it went to Southeast Asia, China, Japan, and Tibet was relatively later when it went into Tibet from India. And Lama Atisha, I mentioned Lama Atisha, the statue that we have of him. He was an 11th century Indian master. And in the 11th, I don't know, probably before the 11th century, Buddhism in Tibet had been, you know, it really had gotten, it was degenerating. It had really gotten, they used the term polluted. It wasn't true to what Buddhism was supposed to be. And a king in Tibet brought Lama Atisha there. So it took, I don't know how long, to walk from India to Tibet, but he did it. And he brought the teachings back into Tibet and really, really stabilized Buddhism and brought it back to life. And you'll hear his name again because he really took the Buddhist teachings and helped bring those to us as well. And then from his teachings, other books were written on the Lamrim. So we will talk about Lama Atisha again. And then everywhere that Tibet spread, as it spread, he had all cultural differences. He had differences in school, which is good. You know, all the traditions brought their own unique spin on the lineage, including, you know, here in the West, how Buddhism is evolving. You know, you keep it true to the spirit, but you evolve it to the culture and the time of where we're all living. And as it spread, it was integrated more and more in the culture and the traditions of the time. So, for example, in Tibet, so how many of you ever walked into a Zen center? Looks very different than this. It's white walls. That's it. No color. You know, it's very sterile. Is not the word I want to use, but yeah, it's sterile. You know, it's just no decorations. You meditate looking at the blank white walls, and that's a tradition that many people like of Tibetan Buddhism, of Buddhism, not Tibetan Buddhism. Where Tibetan Buddhism, we have lots of colors, we have prayer flags, we have pictures, and they say it's because of the culture and tradition in Tibet. You know, there's not many flowers that grow, and you know, it's just a limited time of the year when they can grow, and then it's a pretty bland landscape, so the colors you know, just kind of brought that flowery, flavorful, colorful view of Buddhism in Tibet. So that's how some of those have changed through the years. And so then, in addition, as Tibetan Buddhism spread, you have Buddhist traditions that spread as well. And these are called vehicles or yanas, which in Buddhism means vehicle. And Lama Yeshe, who was one of the founders of FPMT, he's no longer alive, although his reincarnate is very much alive and very active in the Buddhist communities. But Lama Yeshe has said it's like when you go on a trip. You want a good vehicle. You want the vehicle that you pick and you're comfortable with to go on that trip, and that gets you where you want to go. And he says same for the yanas of the vehicles for Tibetan Buddhism. And there's three. So you have the Theravadan tradition, or Hinayana as it's known. And it literally means lesser vehicle, the Hinayana tradition, but it's often translated as the individual vehicle, because the focus is on our own liberation, on, you know, eliminating our own suffering and reaching nirvana. So it relies on sutras in the Pali language is where it came from, and it spread from India to Sri Lanka, so, and then Southeast Asia. So it's more of a southern tradition of Buddhism as it traveled there. And the emphasis is on meditation to develop concentration so that you can liberate yourself and reach that state of nirvana. So the other yana, the other vehicle, is the Mahayana vehicle, which literally means greater vehicle, but it's often translated to mean universal vehicle. And we are the Mahayana tradition. And this is focusing on full enlightenment, our own enlightenment, but for the purpose of, you know, not just our enlightenment, but to help all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. Not just ourselves. So the primary motivation is helping others. So it's more of a northern tradition. It's recorded in the Sanskrit language, and in this northern tradition, Mahayana spread to China, Tibet, Korea, and as well as Vietnam. And I've heard this quote before, that if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. You know, His Holiness says that practicing compassion is the most self-centered, altruistic thing we can do, because it benefits us as well as other people. So practicing compassion is more in the Mahayana tradition. And then the other vehicle is the Vajrayana vehicle, and it's part of the Mahayana and Tibetan traditions. And this emphasis is on transforming ourselves, and you transform your body and your mind into a Buddha using meditation. And it's called the Tantric Path. We have practitioners here in the West that do practice, you know, the Vajrayana, our practice, the tantric method. This is usually great yogi practitioners and people who have studied for years and years and years in Tibet. But this practice is also beginning to spread. This tantric path, it's considered the quick path to enlightenment, so it's often symbolized like a lightning bolt. So when you can practice that. And then there's other traditional differences. Tibetan Buddhism emphasizes study and debate. And debates are a great way to learn. Have any of you ever seen monks debate, seen a TV show or Oh, it's fun. It's just so fun to watch. So they, you have to, so we practice. Did you do those? So we did some here at the center where we debated. I found it really intimidating. And then we practiced in people's homes, but so it would be whatever topic we were studying, and you'd have to debate it convincingly on how, what that meant. And then other people would like, no way. And, and then they would debate their, their view. But when you watch these monks do it, when they're making a point, like they're making their point of what something means, and then they do this. They slide their hand and they lift up their foot and put it down and slide their hand. It's like in your face. God, you try to counteract that one. So it's really, really kind of fun. I've only, I don't remember if the, what was the, no, it wasn't Tom Cruise. He did 7 days in Tibet. No, 7 years in Tibet. I think they showed some debate in that. Maybe something I was watching actually showed it. That was a true story, based on a true story. So it's actually quite good. But then at some teachings, some of the monks will play act debates, and it really is fun to watch. So studying and learning by debates is really important in our tradition. And Japanese Zen Buddhism, the emphasis is on meditation. So it's more that introspection meditation. Now, also studying, just like our tradition, there's also meditation. It's just a little bit of a different emphasis. So we're the Mahayana tradition, and there's four schools in the Mahayana tradition, all pretty similar. We have the Nyingma school, the Kagyu, the Sakya, and the Gelug. And we're the Gelug tradition. These are all Mahayana vehicles, and they're all practiced to become enlightened, to benefit other people. So, that's the focus of all of them. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is in the Gelug tradition, but he studies all the sects. He studies all of them. He has teachers in all the different sects, so it's not like they're all that different. And I've been at teachings where the Karampa of the Kagyu tradition is there on the stage with His Holiness, and they've done teachings together. I was looking for, we used to sell his books in our bookstore. He's got a couple of really good books, and we must be out of them, but we have sold them here, the Karampa's books. And, the thing is we don't make a big distinction between Mahayana and Hinayana. You say greater and lesser, and in our culture that sounds kind of like one's up here and one's down here, kind of one's better than the other. And that wasn't the intentions for this. They're just different, not necessarily better than the other. All the schools focus on the Buddhist teachings. They focus on liberation. It just depends where you are. Even the Lam Rim has a small scope, middle scope, greater scope. Those are the three books of the Lam Rim. And you have to start out in the small scope, understanding what is happiness, what is suffering. I want to be happy. I don't want to suffer. No, everybody wants to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer. You start out with that understanding, and then you keep building on that. So there, again, it's just all those different teachings, just depending on where the person is and what we need to hear and learn. But doesn't mean one's better than the other, or that you should skip one and move on to the other. Any questions about that history? Anything you want to know?
I have one.
Uh-oh. Go ahead. If you don't know the answer, I'm not going to know it, but go ahead.
I'm just wondering where Thich Nhat Hanh fits in. Is he Hinayana or Mahayana, and does Zen fit into Mahayana?
Thich Nhat Hanh is a Mahayana tradition.
He's from Vietnam, which is traditionally Theravadan Hinayana, right?
That's correct. He's a Hinayana. Yes.
Zen Buddhist, right?
No, he is not a Zen Buddhist.
Is Vietnamese.
It's a Vietnamese. Mm. And their focus is, so he's not Mahayana, he's Hinayana. And the focus is very much meditation and mindfulness. Like that's Thich Nhat Hanh's, focus. But we have any of you read any books by Thich Nhat Hanh? Yeah, they're really powerful. And we do have his books in our center as well and in our library. And even though his focus is mindfulness, I mean, his focus is still liberation and compassion and helping other people, very similar.
In Zen, is it Hinayana?
No, Zen is Mahayana. Zen is Mahayana. It's just a different practice of Mahayana than ours. And if I find out I'm wrong, I'll correct it next week, but I'm pretty sure I'm correct. Yes, who else had their hand up?
I was just curious if the different traditions were related to the different... I'm trying to think of the term. Basically, my father bought a Buddha in Thailand 50 years ago, and it's the bald, fat guy.
Yeah.
So how does that...
That was my first Buddha.
Okay. Where does that come from? Is that a different tradition?
Yes. It's a different tradition. I think it's China. It might be... Does Zen have fat Buddhas? I think it's more China, and you rub the belly. It's supposed to bring you good luck. So I walk by my little cement fat Buddha, and I rub his belly. But in our tradition, the Buddha looks, actually, we have some statues that we sell in our bookstore. But the Buddha sitting in the posture, he's very thin. They have some where he's very emaciated, and that represents when he was first sitting under that Bodhi tree. And they're stuffed with holy objects. So you want to make sure when you, like Geshe-la always says, don't buy a Buddha unless you have the instructions for what to look for when you buy a Buddha. And I think you can still download those on our website. If you can't, I'll get them for you. But like we have a couple I don't know whether we have any now, but we should have some Buddhas. There's the Himalayan Tibetan store out at Triangle Town Center, and he has Buddhas in this, in this tradition that are stuffable. If they're not always already stuffed, you stuff them with mantras and holy objects, and then they're blessed. It's a really intensive process, and we usually do that about every other year. People can bring their statues in to be stuffed. I think stuff's the correct word. Is that filled, not stuffed, filled. How do I say stuff does not sound right? They're filled. That's right, and then they're big now. It's really kind of interesting to watch them be filled, stuffed, teasel piece. there's other Tibetan stores in Kerry that sell the Buddhas that can be filled. But there's nothing wrong with having those other Buddhas. You just wouldn't put that on your altar if you were practicing the Tibetan Mahayana tradition. Was there another hand? In the back. Thanks, Hetty.
I was just wondering, you said that they had the long oral tradition. Why didn't they write it down? Why didn't they write the teaching?
I'm not sure. I know it didn't get written down till later. I mean, 2,500 years ago, I don't know what the writing systems were. Were they hieroglyphic? I don't know what they were.
And the ability of people to read was really limited.
That's a good point, too.
It started out as a really strong oral tradition because of the limited, like you couldn't publish a book, you couldn't.
Right. There was no way to get that printed out to everybody. That the oral tradition really did work better for spreading the teachings. We tend to view it differently through our eyes now, but then it was good. Then I always, with the Bible, you hear so many stories about how the Bible was written, and picking out, you know, what stories were going to get told and what weren't, and each of the disciples had their own spin. But in this tradition, it was pretty ironclad, strict. I mean, this was the lineage, and you didn't veer from it. So these are the teachings of the Buddha that we have. So it's pretty amazing, really amazing. Where in the Bible, you could probably pick a handful of things that Jesus really said and did, and that would be about all, you know? So it's interesting.
Did you mention when it was first compiled?
Did you mention when the writings were first compiled and put together?
No, it was in the Sanskrit and Pali tradition. It was a long time ago. I don't know, like the 6th or 7th century, I think. I'm sorry?
A.D.
Thank you. Yeah. Now, it might have been before that. I can't say 100%, but some of those teachings were then. Like, Lama Atisha wrote in the 11th century, and he does have some writings. And that was 11th century, and he wasn't the first. So there, it was before that, for sure. I'll ask Geshe-la.
I have a question.
Where am I?
Here.
Thank you.
When you say it was passed on through a lineage, were there certain people that were designated to having that information to pass on, or was it a family, or who was that lineage?
Yes, and so I don't know all the lineage, but like with the Buddha, he passed it on to the five ascetics that he was hanging out with before he became enlightened, and then they started spreading it from there. And so like we might sit in a teaching, but wouldn't have gotten the oral transmission from them, and I don't know how they selected who got it. Probably pretty enlightened and holy people it spread to.
You mentioned that, like, trying to differentiate Buddhism between a theology and a religion.
Yes.
And it just seems like there's so many parallels with religion, just in talking about, you know, an altar, or, you know, the Buddhist is not a god, but people still tend to worship, it seems like. And so I was wondering if some of the different traditions or are more or less focused on those kind of customs, or just focusing on the teachings versus
the rituals.
Yeah.
And yes, so all of them are different, so I encourage, I don't know that much about other traditions. I know a little bit about Zen just because that was the first thing I dabbled in, and then Thich Nhat Hanh because I liked his readings. And then I loved this tradition, and so I don't know enough to speak to those, but, you know, many of you raised your hand with Catholicism, and I ran from that ritual, and I was like, holy cow, I went from the pot to the frying pan. I like jumped right in. And so this is more of a ritualistic type of a practice, but it's still based on still teachings, and it's really focused on teachings and studyings. And there's many that come here and just do the teachings and the studies, and they don't do some of the rituals that are practiced here. I kind of like both, but go ahead, Hedy.
Well, I was just going to say, I've heard His Holiness say that call Buddhism a religion, but it's non-theistic.
Yes.
There isn't. And the rituals are the Tibetan, you know, that's been applied by the Tibetan people, so other sects of Buddhism or traditions don't have all that stuff.
They don't. They have other little rituals, but not like Tibetan Buddhism. It's pretty much the most. And, you know, it looks like we worship. I think it's kind of confusing because there is no worship here, but it does look that way.
So if the Buddha, he said he was a man, he
yes.
wasn't a prophet, so he wasn't divinely inspired.
No.
84,000 teachings came just through his being enlightened?
Yes. So when the Buddha, he sat under that Bodhi tree and meditated on, you know, what, just trying to find answers. And he saw reality like it was. And so then all of his teachings were to help other people to see what is reality. And we are going to talk about what is reality in upcoming classes. And so he did. It was all from his own enlightenment, what he realized sitting under that tree and trying to find ways to help us get it and understand it. You know, the ultimate sense of reality, not the conventional sense, because obviously we're all sitting here. I can see you, you can see me, but how do we really see each other, and who are we really? And we will talk about that reality. And that's all his teachings are, just to get us to see that, just to get us to see what is reality. And that's the wisdom aspect, right? And why we need compassion, why we need to help others become enlightened. And every teaching he did were for those two aspects. That's it. Anything else? All right. Good questions. Thank you. Doesn't matter how many times you teach this, the questions are always different. It's so awesome. I'm always learning something. So it's good. So we mentioned what it means to be a Buddhist, and we are going to focus more on this as we continue, but it really means inner being. It's a Buddhist is somebody who's looking inward. And you're looking inward for our own happiness and our own cause of our own suffering, and realizing that the mind is the source of both, the happiness and the suffering. So we take complete responsibility for both of those. So it's that inner being. And meditation helps us turn that lens inward and become that inner being. And, you know, we've practiced it. We talked a little bit about it. But, you know, meditation, the word for meditation in Sanskrit is gom, G-O-M. I mentioned that last week, the Sanskrit word. And it just means familiarization, to become familiar. And we're becoming familiar with our own mind. And we're trying to focus our mind on something virtuous. So mindfulness for the sake of mindfulness, you don't really hear a lot about that here. You'll hear about you'll hear about meditation for concentration, but the goal is, you know, the concentration so we can focus on positive or virtuous states of mind. It's all to develop those, and that's what really leads to a more peaceful mind. We have two types of meditation in Tibetan Buddhism. You have focused meditation and analytical meditation. So it's that concentration or focused meditation where you're focusing on an object indefinitely for as long as you want, and your mind never, you know, varies from that, never weaves. You know, we use our breath for our focus, our concentration. We can't even count to 10 without our mind spinning off, constantly bringing it back. And that is the practice of the concentration, of focusing our mind where we want it to focus. Once you get the focus, you know, the little bit of concentration or focus, although Geshe-la keeps saying, don't wait too long, then you use the analytical type of meditation where you're analyzing a topic or a teaching, where you're really trying to get deeper, you're trying to get that experiential understanding of whatever you were whatever you were studying or reading about. And so, you know, it's to gain that experience. Some analytical meditations are, you know, can be very visual, very complicated, and some are really simple, like focusing on your breath, but they're just as powerful nonetheless. It doesn't matter how simple or complicated they are. Again, it's based on what we need, what our mind needs to help us build that concentration and our focus. So we practice that focus attention without all the to-dos trying to enter our mind. You know, that's our kind of goal. The goal takes of this type of meditation is effort. So people think that, oh, I'm going to relax when I meditate, or I meditate to fall asleep. Great. You know, if that helps you fall asleep, do it. But it takes effort and concentration, and that will help us relax and find that peaceful mind in the end. But the act of meditation is focus and effort and work so that we can build that, that concentration. So when thoughts pop up, you try not to follow the storyline, you try not to have any judgment, you try to let it go. As soon as you realize your mind has, you know, varied from your object of your focus, you just, there goes my mind. That's what our mind does, right? We shouldn't expect it not to. That's what your mind does constantly. We're training our mind by then making it come back to the focus on our object. So no sense in getting upset with our mind. It's just, no, I'm not going to think about my to-do list or that meeting tomorrow or what I eat for supper. Whatever it is, you're bringing your concentration back. So let's practice that real quickly. We'll do a quick meditation, and then we'll move on to what is mind, and we may never get to the Four Noble Truths tonight. We'll see. If we don't get to them tonight, we'll get to them next week. But we'll try. We might have time. We'll just do a quick meditation to practice. And this one will, we did the scanning of the body. We'll do a bare attention and counting our breath. So sit in a comfortable position. Just gently close your eyes, and if that's not comfortable, just gaze downward. And take a few nice centering breaths. And just return your breathing to a nice normal rhythm. And focus your attention at the opening of your nostrils. And pay attention to the very subtle sensations as you breathe in and out through your nose. You can feel certain sensations as the air passes, as the small hairs move. Maybe it's cooler as you inhale. And then you should notice that it's warmer as you exhale. Don't follow the air into your body or out into the surrounding environment right now. Just place your attention right there at your breath, at the tip of your nostrils. And think of yourself as a gatekeeper. You're just watching the breath flow past as it enters and exits the body, keenly observing everything that arises in this area of focus. And if it helps, you can mentally note in and out. And just keep laser sharp focus on the sensation of your breath at the tip of your nose, noticing every sensation. When your mind wanders, as it will, as soon as you realize it, just gently and kindly bring your attention back to the sensations at the tip of your nose as you inhale and exhale. If your mind is especially scattered or distracted, try placing more emphasis in your meditation on the element of concentration, focusing your mind more firmly on your breath. Realize distraction is normal. You can be distracted by a thought, by an external sound like a train, or the sensations in your body, itching, pain. As soon as you notice this, take note. Return your attention back to your breath. Now, as you gain a deeper level of concentration and focus, you can kind of loosen your concentration slightly and place greater emphasis on the element of mindfulness in your meditation. And you can practice that a little now. Just play with it. Allow your mind to be attentive and observant of whatever comes that you notice, regardless of what it is. Just don't judge, don't identify, just observe, like a tourist, the thoughts that are bubbling up. Allow them to arise as you observe. Ah, my to-do list. Ah, that argument I had today with my partner or my kids. And then let it pass away without getting involved. No storyline, just be aware. So think about any insight you gained by practicing this. Dedicate it that you can keep practicing, gain more and more concentration and insight to help us be better people, more at peace in life, and to bring peace and well-being to others every day. And this is one of those, as you practice, even for just a couple of minutes a day, to really try try to expand this. It might just be a minute or two, and then just try to keep expanding it over the weeks and months so that you can sit for 10 minutes in bare attention, take a little break, come back and sit for 10 more minutes, and then maybe kind of stretch those 10-minute blocks out as well. Builds concentration. It builds that familiarity with where our stories go and our minds tend to wander off. So it can help give you a level of insight. It's amazing kind of things that bubble up. Sometimes I gasp. It's like, holy cow, where did that come from? And the whole idea is to become familiar with our mind. And so what is mind? So if you had a defined mind, what would you say? And if you holler it out, I'll repeat it since we don't have a mic close by. How would you define mind?
Awareness.
Awareness.
Consciousness.
Consciousness. Tell me, say something else. No? Would you say?
CPU, like a computer.
Oh, yeah, that's good. It is. Yeah, I think I told you my hearing is, it's going. But yeah, it is our CPU, right? It's our awareness. It's our consciousness. You know, our mind is constantly taking in data. And so, it's defined, it is awareness. It doesn't have awareness. Our mind is awareness. Its function is to know or knowing. And it's considered to be clear luminosity. It's not a physical form. It's just this clear, luminous consciousness, awareness. And there's different levels of mind in Tibetan Buddhism. There's this subtle level, and there's clear, luminous. It's more of this really very subtle level, but it's covered by our gross mind, and that's how, you know, this is our minds we have right now, where, you know, our senses, we're taking in data, it's constantly taking in information and wandering off. But your clear mind is always there under that. And meditation can help us get to that clear, luminous mind. That's the whole point of meditating, is how can we keep trying to reach that mind. You know, they say that that clear, luminous mind, really great yogis can achieve it during meditation, but like when you sneeze, which, you know, in many traditions they say, God bless you, like when you sneeze, they say if we could realize it, it's too quick, but if we could realize it, you can catch that clear luminous mind then, and then when we die, that clear luminous mind can be very apparent the more that we do practice. So there's a couple of important points of the mind. Many compare it to a clear blue sky. So that is always there, that clear luminosity. And then our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions are just the clouds that are just going through the mind and or through the sky. And they just kind of pass through until we kind of engage those. So they pass through, or, you know, they just kind of are reflecting on. They're not an inherent part of the sky. You can think of a river if you don't want to think of a sky. You know, a river is a clear lake, but it can get muddied. There's rocks in it. There's ripples. You know, the mud and the rocks aren't part of the water, so that they can, you know, they can be eliminated. Those are like the obscurations. So the mind is consciousness. I said it doesn't have a form. So it's not the brain. Certainly they need each other, but it's not the brain, which is physical form organ. And the consciousness includes our attitudes and emotions. And another important concept in Buddhism is that the mind is continuously changing, and we can change it. We can change it on purpose. And science is catching up with Buddhism. You know, the study of neuroscience realizes that you can not only can change your mind, and you can change the physical structure of your brain by what you're thinking about and what you're doing. It's called neuroplasticity. And through meditation, it's one of the key ways to do that, to strengthen certain neurons, to weaken synapses between others, to begin to change that structure of our brain. And Buddhism has always kind of taught that. This holiness, I mentioned the Mind Life Conference, which was going on last weekend. I forget where. It's been in the United States many times. It was as close as Atlanta. It was going to be at Duke University this year, and then the plans got changed. But where, you know, he interacts with science, you know, with other scientists on this level to talk about Buddhism and science. So there's lots of studies and research being done. Lots of studies on compassion too, which is kind of cool. So they keep kind of paralleling with Buddhist study. So the goal is this notion of mind to keep working until we can get to that really subtle level and begin to control the gross level. That's what we're trying to control. And that's what really is going to lead to our happiness and our peace. And we'll talk about the mind again next week. And is just think about when you're meditating. You know, what is the mind? Is it the brain? If it's not physical, if it's formless, how could it be the brain? You know, what is consciousness or awareness? And just ask yourself those questions as you're meditating, and think about that definition of the mind as clear, luminous. I think of those snow globes. You know, you can shake them up, and you know, you see all this fuzziness going on, that gross level of mind, but if you let it settle, then it all settles down. You know, a dirty mirror, you know, that dirt and smudge, although I think some of mine is permanently on my mirrors, but maybe not, maybe if I scraped hard enough. But for the most part, you can clean them off. You can clean off that grime. Will it come back? Yes. And then you clean it off again, but that mirror, that clear mirror is there if we can get the grime away. So, doesn't have too much to do with our mind, except when you think about suffering and the causes of suffering. And this was the Buddha's first teaching of the turning of the wheel of Dharma. And it was one of the first main teachings he gave with his buddies and a whole group of other people that attended. And there are four noble truths: the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path to the cessation of suffering. And we discussed this last week with the analogy of an illness and a physician, that you have symptoms. First, you have to admit you have symptoms. I had migraines for a year. I couldn't even say the word migraine, just the whole, ugh. So I denied it. I never got help until one day I finally thought, well, dog, I really do have migraines. So you have to admit there's a problem, that you're not feeling well. And then you see the doctor who can make the diagnosis that, yes, there is a cause to this suffering. And then they give you a prescription. This will help you feel better. But then you have to take it. You know, you have to follow, you know, the doctor's order to get rid of that suffering. When things are going well, it's really hard to think about suffering. We're happy, life is good, new job, new car, new boyfriend, new girlfriend, you know, whatever it is that we have. And you know, there's many people that say, I've never suffered. I don't know what suffering is. But it doesn't matter how rich you are, how shiny your car is. it's developing that understanding on a deeper level of what is suffering. And probably a better word instead of suffering is just dissatisfaction. And we'll talk more about that dissatisfaction as well. So the first, we'll get through one noble truth. I just looked at the time. The first noble truth is that truth of suffering. Suffering does exist. That complication, sickness, old age, all of us and all of our loved ones are going to die. There's going to be separation and loss. And we know that as a fact. I have this wonderful app on my phone called We Croak. And five times a day, it pops up and it says, remember you're going to die. And it's just like, oh yeah, and it could be today. And then it gives you this little quote, and some of the little quotes are really ridiculous and some of them are really powerful, but it's just that, yep, I'm going to die. And it can help you live better. We'll talk about the Buddhist view of death in one of the later classes. There's pain and there's suffering, but there's a difference between pain and all types of suffering. So when you think about suffering, you have this suffering of suffering, and this is really what we know of suffering. You know, the headaches, the loss, the, you know, new car that we wrecked. That, you know, whatever it is, like we experience that suffering of suffering, discomfort, pain, traumas of life. And then there's the suffering of change. We did this one when we came in here. We think of things as permanent and fixed, but everything's, you know, that it's unchanging, so that when we're happy, we want it to last forever, and we act like it's going to. And when we're suffering, we think it's going to last forever, and, you know, we think we're kind of never going to get over it as well. But things change constantly. So we walked in this room, and it's kind of cold, and we turned up the heat, and I put my wrap on, and, you know, my wrap's off now. You get kind of hot. You do it when you're in the sun. You're out in the sun, you know, you know, maybe it was cold. It's a nice sunny day. You go out. You can't wait to be in the sun, and then you get too hot, and you have to, you know, go back in and cool off. You know, you're at the beach or a pool, and you jump in the water because you want to cool off, and then you get too cold, and you got to come out because, you're going to get, you need to get warmed up. So we constantly have this suffering of change. You take a bite of a chocolate cake, and it's so good. It's so tasty. If you eat the whole cake, it's gonna make you sick, you know? It's there. The new car, you polish it, you keep it clean, you love looking at it, you take such good care of it, it's the perfect color, it's the perfect style for you, you love the way it looks, and how long is it going to be new and shiny? How long is it going to have that new smell? And then what do we do once it's scratched or it breaks down, which it will? Or the new color comes out, and all of a sudden your new running shoes or your new car or your new iPhone, now there's a newer gadget that comes out. Same with relationships. You're happy, you're in love, you think it's going to last forever, and then you start complaining, finding fault, bickering. You know, next thing you know, you're dividing albums, although people probably don't have albums anymore. You're dividing CDs. Everything's changing. And we act like that quality is inherent in that object that's changing, and we'll talk about that, but there's nothing fixed. And then there's all pervasive suffering, or compounded suffering, which is the hardest one for most people to understand. But it's that fundamental way we see things. You know, the Buddha saw reality as it was. He could see things as they really were. Most of us can't. We exaggerate the good and we exaggerate the bad in things we see. Just this fact of this cyclic existence, and you might not believe in rebirth, but, you know, we're here on this earth, and we're creating things that are going to cause us to come back again in who knows what form and be reborn again over and over again. So just this cyclic existence based on karma that causes this all-pervasive suffering. Doesn't matter how rich, happy, young, healthy people are, we all have the suffering of change and we all have pervasive suffering, and sooner or later, even they're going to have the suffering of suffering at some point. So I'm going to end here with, at the end of the first of the Four Noble Truths. Oh, what a way to end, the suffering of sufferings. But no, the cessation of suffering's coming next week, so you have to come back to be able to get out of the suffering. Just take a second before you get up and leave. Just close your eyes. You made the effort to come here. Just dedicate even that effort that it may grow and grow, that you'll keep studying and to get you to have the effort and energy to come back again next week. And whatever else you want to dedicate, really important to do before you get up and leave. So if you ever have to leave early or whatever reason, just dedicate as you're getting up. It takes just a few seconds to do that. And then we will finish up the Noble Truths next week. We'll talk a little bit more about rebirth and karma. Karma is always a big topic to understand. Again, feel free to email me. You have my email, but you can get information off of our center. If there's any questions, I will take those. And feel free, if you have to leave, leave. And if you want to come up and ask the questions after, you can come up and ask questions. And because we're going to talk about our attachments and how to get rid of those attachments. Thank you very much for coming. I look forward to seeing you all next week.